Like your creepy old lady voice right there for a second.
Oh, yeah? You like that?
Yeah, in the way that I hated it.
Okay. Hi.
Hi.
How?
What kind of chips are you eating?
I'm eating wavy Lay's.
So I know that you like the, what are they? The Zaps?
Yeah.
Is that what it's called? Have you had the, like, Cajun Crawdad? Whatever. Are they good?
I like them. I have a hard time saying no to a salty snack, though.
Yeah.
There's not a lot of chips I don't like. I haven't had the ketchup or the dill pickle, because those are a little, I'm looking at them a little like, But
I've liked the ketchup and dill pickle chips I have had in the past, but I can't speak for this brand. But one of our, so we never had, like, Zaps or Utz or anything in, like, Oklahoma. But I remember them, like, from when I lived in Virginia, because Utz is, like, the potato chip in Virginia. And so we were out shopping at just, like, one of our little, like, small kind of neighborhood grocery stores, and they had both Zaps and Utz, and I was like, we're buying 6 bags of potato chips and no one's gonna stop me. And Elise was like, what are these? And I was like, these are the best chips you'll ever have. We ate like 3 bags of the voodoo flavor in like 3 days.
The voodoo, like, ones are so good.
They got the evil eye, and I don't know, are those just spicier?
I haven't tried those ones.
Okay.
But I will. I can let you know.
Hey, Utz and Zaps.
Sponsor us.
Sponsor us.
Not sponsored.
You're listening out there.
Yes.
I would love to be sponsored.
I'm choosing the wavy Lay's because they were on sale.
Fair.
But I rarely say no to a potato chip, which you would know if you ever saw me. People of the internet, I do not look like the kind of girl who says no to a potato chip, and it is true. I would not. There's one I had, I can't remember if it was Utz or whatever, or hers, but there was one, and it was cheddar and horseradish, and it was really good.
Oh, that sounds so good.
I'm a horseradish.
All right, anyway. Welcome to The Strange and Unusual, where we discuss the strange and unusual. This is episode 113 of our series, seeking out the weird, the unexplained, and the devious from around the world. I'm Raya.
And I'm a horseradish.
This episode, we're taking a dive into a couple of spies.
We're not diving into spies. That would be like the weirdest Scrooge McDuck ever.
Why not? Sounds great.
Sounds messy.
It sounds like an episode of Magic School Bus.
The one where they go into Arnold and he's eating the olives.
Yep.
That's a good one. He eats like Cheetos and olives. I don't know. Anyway, hi. Social media.
All right. You can find us on social media.
We're not high. We are not drunk.
I am not.
We're just happy to be having a conversation together.
But yeah, you can find us on social media. We're on Facebook, Instagram. What did you call it? Instagram.
Instagram.
Instagram. Instagram, Twitter. Just search for the Strange and Unusual podcast. You can also find us on Patreon at patreon.com/strangeandunusual. As always, all this information will be at the end of the show in more detail, as well as in the show notes to help you guys with spelling or whatever.
So what are we talking
about? What are you talking about?
All right. I will tell you that I'm talking about a little lady, Christine Granville.
I'm not going to tell you who I'm talking about because it's part of my intro to who I'm talking about.
Okay, fine. That means I go first, I guess.
I mean, you can. I can. You can. I don't care.
I'll go. Wait. Okay. Yeah, I went first. Or I went last time. So I'll go first.
Okay.
Either way, it ends in death, right? Either way, it's about Nazis, right? So
yeah,
doesn't really matter who goes first. So wee woos. It's World War II.
That's exactly my wee woo.
Yeah, war, Nazis, torture, sexism, prisoners, capture, suicide, feminine sexual liberation, World War II. Born in Poland on May 1st, 1908, Christina Skarbek was the daughter of a Jewish mother and a dubious count father. He actually paid off his debts from his marriage to his wife. Like, he had debts and then they got married and he used that dowry to pay things. But she was a daddy's girl. She liked horseback riding and she rode astride, not side saddle, like a little bitch. She was like, she was into it. She was also a big skier. She wasn't a girl who fit in easily and she had to learn to advocate for herself at a young age. But she was described as a striking beauty from very young as well. The family's financials worsened and her father ended up passing from tuberculosis in 1930. We all remember about tuberculosis, right?
Yeah, we've done several episodes with it.
Not willing to be a financial burden on her mother, Christina decided to start working for a while. She ended up at a car dealership but had to quit because she was having lung issues from the car fumes. Originally, they actually thought she had gotten tuberculosis, but not so, and that's important later. But she was basically told, like, you can't work here anymore. You need to be in a place with more open air. So she was not able to work there. She also entered a beauty pageant, and I found varying results on this. Some said she won. Others said that she was the runner-up. But she did very well in this beauty pageant and, like, was almost Miss Poland or was Miss Poland. She was briefly married once and divorced before meeting a man named Yershi Gizeki. Yershi Gizeki. Gizek. Whatever. One of those. So, one source described him as a large fellow twice her age. He had run away from home at the age of 14 and was a cowboy in Texas, a gold prospector in Colorado, a lumberjack in Oregon, and even a driver for John Rockefeller. He was offered a position as a secretary for the Polish litigation in Washington, D.C., and then he was on the Polish Olympic Committee for the 1924 Olympics in Paris. He went on an expedition to West Africa and he became an author. So he was an exciting kind of gentleman that she would be interested in meeting. They met when he saved her from a potentially nasty skiing incident. So he certainly matched her love for adventure. They were married in November of 1938 in Warsaw before he was appointed to the position of consul general in Ethiopia. That was until the German invasion of Poland in September of 1939. The couple actually fled to London that October. Claire Mulley, the author of one of her biographies about Christina, she actually claimed that on the boat over to London, there was a message board where a sign said something like, lost one woman's pair of underwear. And then under that was another sign that said, lost Warsaw. Like the British and their humor. Eager to help with the war effort and liberate her country, Christina got herself a meeting with George Taylor of the Secret Intelligence Service, which was no small feat itself. There are SIS documents from December of that same year calling her a, quote, flaming Polish patriot and a woman who was, quote, absolutely fearless. She started her career with the British SIS, which would later become a label under the Special Operations Executive, or the SOE. I think I read that she was the first and longest serving female spy for the British during World War II. She was the first agent they sent to Hungary, where she posed as a journalist in Budapest. Britain's first special... She actually had an Olympic skier that she likely knew through her husband help her sneak across the treacherous Tatra Mountains into what was at this point, not currently, but at the point in the story, occupied by Nazis. I don't think that part of Poland is now, in this moment that you are hearing this, actively occupied by Nazis. I wrote that poorly. Anyway, it was such a dangerous passage at the time that the Nazis didn't even patrol the area. Conditions would have been as low as like negative 20 Celsius, which is about negative 4 Fahrenheit. She saw bodies as she passed, people who had attempted to flee on their own and had frozen to death in the on the mountains. And she made that crossing something like 6 times, starting in the winter of between 1939 and 1940. And during those times in Poland, she had some interesting encounters. For one, she tried to convince her mother to flee, but she refused. And unfortunately, she would end up being detained by Nazis in 1942 and then disappear in the prisons. In 1940, Christina was recognized by an old acquaintance and approached in a cafe, called her out by her name, and she could have been made, but she denied who she was to the woman and said she was mistaken. And then she just like chilled casually in the cafe for a while before leaving. Like, I don't want to cause a scene. I'm just going to chill here and drink my coffee.
Yeah.
She smuggled
because it would have been weird if she would have just like immediately left.
Exactly. So she smuggled in propaganda, money, weapons for the resistance. She made contacts with their intelligence. She took on lovers. She even had a few run-ins with the Gestapo. In one event, she was with one of these lovers I just mentioned. They were being stopped by the police. They were going through her bag and she noticed that they were taking her money. So while the man she was with was preparing cyanide so that they could end themselves before the Nazis could torture them to death, Christina was working out a plan to survive. Seeing that the greed was playing a part in their search, she started fidgeting with her necklace. It was made of like cut glass, and she broke the necklace and started screaming, "My diamonds, my diamonds!" And the Nazis ran over to like pull up her diamonds off the ground, and the two took off, and she said that they barely made it into the woods before the bullets started whizzing over their heads. The next story is of the man that Christina, by all accounts, considered to be the love of her life, Andrzej Kowarski. So Andrzej was a Polish army officer and agent who had lost part of his leg in a hunting accident in his youth. So because of this, he wore a prosthetic. He couldn't do those dangerous trips skiing into Poland with her, but he worked out of Hungary, arranging escape routes for refugees and POWs. Several thousands were rescued, including trained pilots, which were sorely needed by the Allies. In fact, two of the squadrons with the highest kill count in the Battle of Britain were two Polish squadrons. So once he had there, oh, this is a great story. He had once been taken to a concentration camp, but ended up hot wiring a car and escaping. And before he got to the gate, he turned back around and went to get the rest of his unit before leaving. And together, Andrzej and Christina would monitor traffic along the borders of Germany and Romania. This is where she's also credited with providing intel on the oil transports out of Romania into Germany. They smuggled information together. He helped by whittling a hole into his prosthetic leg where he could hide notes for her. And by 1941, she and Kowarski were arrested and questioned by the Gestapo. She ended up biting her tongue to pool blood in her mouth and then, quote, coughed up the blood, feigning like she had tuberculosis, which, you remember, is exceptionally contagious. So one source I saw said that they had x-rayed her chest for confirmation, and they actually could see scar tissue, which had been caused by her working in all those car fumes. But they did believe she had TB because of it and was on death's door, so they were released. But they knew they were being followed also. Some of the most vital information she got to the British was the microfilm of photos taken from Polish intelligence, troops and supplies being built up at the border of the Soviet Union. As we now know that they did, in June of 1941, invade the USSR in Operation Barbarossa. But the information at the time going to Churchill, he didn't believe it. He was like, I don't know about this. This seems like that would be dumb for Germany to go into the Soviet Union, which it was. But then he started getting more intel, and then he was like, yeah, this is probably going to happen. Or, y'all, this is probably going to happen. You know, something like that. So Christina and Andrzej make it to the top of Gestapo's Most Wanted, and they figured it's time to vamoose. And in 1940, Hungary abandoned their neutrality and ended up siding with the Nazis, which we hate. But Andrzej and Christina were aided by the British ambassador to Hungary and given British passports with new names, Anthony Kennedy and Christine Granville, a name which she would formally adopt later, so that's why I'll be calling her that from here on out. She also took that opportunity to shave 7 years off of her age, putting that she was born in 1915. Andrzej would.
Why not?
Yeah, right? I would. Andrzej would drive out in the Opel, the pretty popular car at the time, the one that he had stolen from the concentration camp. So I assume it's the same vehicle. I cannot confirm, but it would have matched up. Christine, meanwhile, was smuggled out in the trunk of one of the embassy's cars. But together they fled to Yugoslavia, then Bulgaria. They ended up in Istanbul, Turkey, where shit gets awkward because guess who's waiting for them there? Christine's husband, Yershi. I couldn't find that any beef went down between them, but I still think that would have been mega awkward. he ended up going back to Budapest to take Christine's place as a point of contact between the Polish resistance and the British. So as the fleeing couple traveled from country to country, they carried different intel and microfilm. She would hide it in her gloves, often rolling through these countries days or weeks ahead of the Nazi advancement. And they finally arrived at the British territory, Cairo, Egypt, because colonialism. The SOE in Cairo, however, was suspicious of the couple and their ability to travel through Nazi sympathetic countries, which is fair. The two were dismissed of their espionage duties and they were left essentially destitute for a dime. She did get a small pension, but basically spent 2 years with nothing to do. When her husband found out she had been dismissed, he also said, he was like, all right, well, fuck you then. I'm not going to work for you either. And he quit.
And it was actually around this time that she confessed that she was in love with Andre. And here she was like, cool, 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 cool. And went back to London and then emigrated to Canada. And then they formally got divorced in 1946. Being the woman she was, she refused desk work, though she was considered too high risk to go back into Central Europe, where everybody kind of knew her. And she was still suspected by some to be a double agent, although Andre was cleared of suspicion on his own. She was able to aid in collection and passing of small amounts of intel in Syria and Cairo. Eventually, she joined a group called FANNY, First Aid Nursing Yeomanry. And this was a sort of charity situation, but it also operated as a cover with military-style uniforms for many women within the SOE. She was trained in wireless transmitting, firearms, and parachuting. Guess which one was her favorite?
Firearms.
By 1944, she was told she's getting sent to southern France. And on the night of July 6th, / the early morning of July 7th, she parachutes in and makes her way for Vercors, France, where she's going to work under Francis Camertz. This area was made up of difficult terrain and was hard to navigate through, so it was mostly ignored by German troops in France. And she joined this team that would organize French resistance fighter called the Maquis, which if you're a Star Trek fan, you know about the Maquis. But they were there to basically weaken German troops before the Allied invasion of Operation Dragoon would come in, which was somewhat after Normandy happened. The Maquis would use the cover of the dense forest and caves to travel unseen to do this. So Christine's new alias was Pauline, a French noblewoman who had fallen on hard times, and that's how she would get around. They gave her a revolver and a cyanide pill should she need it. And those were meaningful things because in 1944, over 100 British SOE agents had been captured and tortured for information in France alone. Himmler's order was to only kill spies after they'd been properly tortured into giving up all the information they had. That's fun. So in fact, Christine was actually sent as a replacement for Camert's former courier, Cecily Lefort, who had been arrested by the Gestapo in September on 1944 and deported to Ravensbrück concentration camp, and she was executed in February of 1945. So Christine was tasked with subverting Polish soldiers that had been conscripted by the Germans and stationed on the border between France and Italy. She was able to convince hundreds of them to change sides. She was responsible for the dissension of an entire garrison of Polish soldiers to the Maquis. She turned a number of Italian units against Germany. She knew how to talk to men. And during her time with the Maquis, there would be these drops of like allies dropping ammo and weapons in the Vercors Plateau. And she wasn't quite there a month when the Maquis took these drops and mounted a full-scale rebellion. Unfortunately, though, they kept requesting heavy artillery from the Allies, and they only received small arms. So the rebellion was quickly quashed by the German troops. Vercors was massacred. Resistance groups all over the country were rising up to distract the Germans and keep them tied up from the Allied invasion. There's a cemetery in Vesoul honoring the memory of this resistance, and even nurses, doctors, and patients well enough to walk out of these Maquis cave hospitals were deported to concentration camps by the Germans at the time. That August, just days before Operation Dragoon landing in Provence, Camertz and two others were arrested at a roadblock. Christine tried to convince French resistance leaders to help, but they were like, you know, understandably busy at the time. So she rode her bike 25 miles, intending to do it her damn self. On August 13th, she circled the prison, humming a favorite tune of hers and Camert's called Frankie and Johnny. And he heard her from a window and started humming back to confirm that he was inside. So basically, she walks up to the French captain, who was acting as a liaison to the Gestapo. She says, I'm Camert's wife and the niece of a famed British general, Bernard Montgomery, which is a real guy, but I just screwed up saying his name. And he was really guy, really. She told him that they would all be... So she tells this captain, like, you're all going to be lynched during the Allied invasion if my prisoners are harmed, like if you hurt them. And so she brokered and bribed for their release. And here's a quote from Madeline Mason's book, Christine. Apparently she said, if I were you, said Christine, I should give a careful thought to the proposition I have made you. As I've told the other captain, if anything should happen to my husband or to his friends, the reprisals would be swift and terrible, for I don't have to tell you that both you and the captain have an infamous reputation among the locals. Basically, we will drag you through town and let everybody do what they want to you.
Which, I mean, why not do that anyway?
It's Nazis. We stand. So Camertz and the other two men were led from the prison, certain that they were going to be executed, only to be led to awaiting Christine. 2 days later, Allied troops arrived to liberate the area. When Granville and Camertz met with the U.S. Brigadier General Frederick Butler, he was allegedly pretty dismissive, and that really pissed Christine off. She's like, I'm risking my fucking life out here and you're going to act like this. But they were later approached and actually appointed liaisons to the Maquis by the superior officer, General Alexander Patch. So she basically got to look at Butler and be like, nee, 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 fuck you, like in French or Polish, I don't know. With the war all but won, Christine returned to Britain, where she worked with officials in the British-Polish alliance to try and counter the invasion of the Red Army into Poland. For all of her services, she received the George Medal from Britain and was made an officer and the order, or officer of the Order of the British Empire. That's a lot of prepositions. She had received a higher level award than that of any other woman in the SOE receiving because of the amount of work she did. She was also awarded with the French Croix de Guerre, which was for her contribution to the French liberation, as well as the highest honor in Poland for her aid there. Kamerz named his daughter after her in 1948. Without much else to do in the espionage world at the time, she took a number of odd jobs, which seems to be a revolving door of jobs and lovers, including reunited with Kowarski, the love of her life. She was a stewardess on a passenger ship. She likely had a romantic affair with a fellow steward named Dennis Muldowney, which she later broke off, and she blamed it on his obsessive behavior, calling him obstinate and terrifying.
Yeah.
On July 15th, 1952, Christine Granville's life came to an end when she was stabbed to death in her hotel when she was only 44 years old, or 37 if you're going by her new passport. Her killer was none other than obstinate and terrifying Dennis Muldowney, which, let's just talk about the name Dennis for a minute and what that means for Dennis's all over the world. Like, you gotta like really work to get out of that now. He was found guilty and hanged on September 30th of that same year. Granville was interred at St. Mary's Roman Catholic Cemetery in Northwest London. Andre Kowarski and several other men from her life, including Kamerz, worked together to ensure that her name was kept clean and no one tried to write any tawdry tales about her life, because she did have a very open sex life, and they didn't want her to be, like, dragged through the mud for it. When she was buried, over 200 people attended her funeral, including representatives from British, Polish, and French government. Laughingly, her death certificate listed her occupation as former wife. Andre died in Germany in 1988, and his ashes were flown to London, where they were interred at the foot of her grave. Clearly a remarkable lady, her legacy as a beauty queen spy lives on. And she was said to have been Churchill's favorite spy and the original Bond girl, serving as inspiration for Vesper Lynd in Ian Fleming's Casino Royale. And I think she's just one of the coolest bitches I've ever read about. Because
yeah,
if I was pretty enough to be a beauty queen, I don't think I would be throwing my life into harm's way when I could, like, get away with other shit. I would ride that ticket as far as it would take me. So.
Well, we live in a different society now.
That's true. That's true. But that's Christine Granville, and I think she's great. And that's all I have to say. That's all I have to say about that. Stick with my Forrest Gump references.
That would have been a good joke to make last week's episode with the magic cellar.
Mama said it was my magic cellar.
All right,
they were gonna take me anywhere.
Take me back to Indonesia.
Okay, yep, we're good. Right. Cool.
All right, so we lose. It's World War II.
Excellent.
So I've got a question for you. Well, not you, because you know, but our great listeners out there. What do the Lord of the Rings, Star Wars, Nazi hunting, and metal music all have in common? Christopher Lee has taken part in all of them.
I love it. Oh god, I can't remember what album it is that he was on that I was like, that's fucking Christopher Lee.
He's on several.
I know, but I was like, there's one in particular that I'm like, what was that one?
Yeah, he was, I talk about it a little bit, but he's like on a Manowar album. He's put out like three albums of his own.
Oh, dang.
He was on the soundtrack for the original Wicker Man.
Mm.
Like,
well, I mean, yeah, because he was freaking...
He's an opera singer, too.
He was the Laird, or the Lord, in Wicker Man, which is one of my favorite parts of his.
Yeah, it was also his favorite part.
Oh, well, it was amazing, obviously. I love when he was in the dress and skipping up the hill. It was so good.
So, Sir Christopher Lee was born on May 27th, 1922, in Belgravia, London. His father was Lieutenant Colonel Geoffrey Trollope Lee, and his mother, it can't be Trollope.
Are you sure?
I'm pretty sure.
If I can name my daughter Jezebel.
And his mother was Countess Estelle Marie.
Ooh, a countess.
So, yeah, his mother's lineage could actually be traced back to Charlemagne.
Dang.
And his father's lineage, he could, was distantly related to,
Jesus.
To Robert, I think it was Robert E. Lee.
Oh, okay.
It was Lee or Grant. It was one of the two Civil War generals.
Oh, okay.
One of the two main ones.
One of those two guys.
So when he was 4 years old, his parents separated and then divorced 2 years later. His mother, his sister, and himself moved to Switzerland briefly, and after enrolling in school there, he played his first role in the school play as Rumpelstiltskin.
Ooh, I love that for him.
Eventually, they would return to England, and his mother would marry Harcourt George St. Croix Rose, which is Jesus.
I thought you said hardcore. I was like, hardcore.
He was a banker, and he was actually the uncle of Ian Fleming,
interesting,
the author of the James Bond novels.
We're bringing it all together. Mm-hmm. We're going full circle.
He was also introduced to Prince Yusupov and Grand Duke. What? Did I just completely butcher that?
No, I just, you kind of did like a tiny pause, and I thought you were just saying he was introduced to Prince.
Oh, he's just Prince, period.
The artist formerly known as Prince.
No, he was introduced to Prince Yusupov and Grand Duke Dmitry Pavlovich, the assassins of Rasputin, who he would later play in a movie. He would continue acting all throughout his early years of school, but like many of us, he struggled in math.
Yeah, been there, pal.
While he attended Wellington College, though, he didn't act, primarily focusing on his studies. So he was on the road to go to a more prestigious school, but like, they could take 10 people or something, and he was 11. Like, he just missed the cutoff.
Like waiting list material.
Yeah, and then there was another prestigious school that he was going to try to get into, but they didn't qualify for, like, the scholarship that he needed, and his stepfather couldn't afford to put him in that school.
That sucks.
So he went to the Wellington College instead. He would say that he was passable at playing racket ball. And he was a passable fencer, which I disagree. I was reading that.
Sorry, Chris Lee. I'm gonna disagree with you there.
Well, I think he's being humble because Christopher Lee has had more on-screen sword fights than any other actor.
Interesting. Even Vigo?
Yeah, and he was just like actually like a professional fencer.
Wow.
Like, and he's just like, I was okay at it. Yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Likely story.
He did well at cricket as well, but he did not do well in any other sports that he tried.
No, oh, poor guy.
And he tried all of them, basically, from the list that I found. He did not enjoy the parades or weapons training and would always play dead in mock battles as soon as he could, which is very relatable to me.
I can relate. No good at maths and playing dead. That's me.
Yeah, just lay down in the grass and look up at the sky. Like,
yep.
He was a bit of a troublemaker in school, which resulted in frequent beatings for him, including one where he was beaten for being beaten too often.
You know what's so funny? Before I picked out Christine Granville, I almost thought about doing Roald Dahl.
Uh-huh.
And one of his notes that I took was that he was actually caned so much as a kid for being in trouble that he had difficulty sitting for the rest of his life. Like, he couldn't sit for more than a few hours at a time. And I was like, can you imagine living in a time when it's just like, let's just beat this kid until it hurts him to sit for the rest of his life?
At 17, his stepfather actually had gone bankrupt, and his mother separated from him.
Oh no!
As a result,
that poor guy.
Kicking him when he's down.
Damn.
Christopher had to get a job, but most of the employees at the time were already preparing or were going on summer holidays, so there just like weren't jobs
right
at the time for him to get, like, especially like a entry level, like with training and stuff. They just didn't have the people there. So instead of getting a job immediately, he went to the French Riviera, and stopped briefly in Paris, where he stayed with a friend of his mother, journalist Webb Miller. While staying in Paris, he witnessed Eugene Weidman's execution by guillotine, the last public execution in France.
Damn.
He stayed with the Russian Mazarov family while in Menton, France. And it was arranged for him to continue staying there. And the Mazarov family had, were basically political escapees, who had gone to France for basically sanctuary.
Now it makes me wonder if they were connected with the Anastasia dupe.
Possibly.
I can't remember.
So he stayed in France for a while, but he did end up returning to London because war was looming. At the time, it was the Winter War. So it was the steps before World War II started. So he would work as an office clerk in London for the U.S. lines, taking care of mail and running errands. And in 1939, he enrolled with a military academy and volunteered to fight for the Finnish army against the Soviet Union in the Winter War. He was sent to, he went with a bunch of his, other kids or people who are around his age. They had rallied a group together to go and volunteer to try to help out and do this.
That's awesome.
But because he could not ski, he basically wasn't allowed to go very far into the situation, because it was considered too much of a liability for him to.
Yeah.
And most of the people who went with him to try to volunteer and help were kept at the border, but safely away from the border. So they didn't actually see any combat and were basically just on guard duty. And after just 2 weeks, they returned home.
Oh.
He would later say in an interview that he knew how to shoot, but not how to ski, and that he probably would have died if he had actually been allowed to go to the fronts.
Yeah.
He returned to work at the United States lines and found that his work was more satisfying, feeling like he was contributing to the war efforts by passing the information through. He would move on to work at Beecham's as an office clerk and then a switchboard operator, but the company, due to the threat of war, would move out of London. He went to join the Home Guard after that. And then his father passed away from bilateral pneumonia in March of 1941.
Ooh.
While he had no real inclination to join the army, he decided to join up while he still had some choice in which arm of the military he joined.
That's fair.
So he volunteered for the Royal Air Force. He reported to the RAF Uxbridge, for training and passed his exams in Liverpool. This saw him transfer to South Africa and then his posting at Hillside in South Rhodesia. While there, he had his final training with De Havilland Tiger Moths before his first solo flight.
What now?
What
was it called?
De Havilland Tiger Moths.
Tiger Moms.
Oh.
It's what?
Excuse yeah, Tiger me? Moths. I assume that they're a flight,
a platoon type of plane or something. Yeah,
well, I think that it's the platoon, how they would have the Simpsons. It's the screaming hellfish or something.
Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah.
You have a name for your group. I don't know anything about the military, as you may have noticed.
Yeah, we're good.
I don't know any terminology.
We don't know. If AJ wasn't in the bathroom, I would ask him because he would probably know.
So while he was in his first solo flight, he actually suffered a debilitating headache and severely blurred vision.
Oh, gosh.
It was diagnosed as a failure of his optic nerve, and he was never allowed to fly a plane again.
Oh, no.
Christopher was devastated, and after hearing of the death of one of his fellow trainees from his original school, he grew even more despondent. No matter how much he appealed, he was left with nothing to do. He was transferred to different stations until he was finally posted to Southern Rhodesia's capital in December of 1941. After seeing the area he was in and, exploring, because he'd never been here before, he decided that he needed to do something more constructive and appealed to join the RAF intelligence wing. His superiors praised the idea, and he was moved to the South African police and was posted as a warden at Salisbury Prison. He was then promoted to lead aircraftman and moved to Durban, South Africa, before traveling to Suez. While in Suez, he continued his forward momentum, being attached to the number 205 group before becoming a pilot officer at the end of January 1943. Then he was attached to number 260 as an intelligence officer. As the North African campaign moved forward, his squadron moved between Egyptian airstrips. So basically what he would say, what he said he was doing, which there's some controversy as to if any of this actually happened or not, which I'll get into a little bit. But he was basically saying that they were going through these airships and were disabling German planes.
Okay.
As they were moving through. And so they would just, like, move in, disable all of the planes, and then fall out and go to the next airstrip and do the same thing. And they were just doing that as they were traveling through Egypt toward their actual goal, which was Libya.
Okay.
So they're just disabling every German vehicle of any kind that they come across as they're going. They lent air support to ground forces and bombed strategic targets. The Allies advanced into Libya and then continued further. The squad was completing an average of 5 missions a day.
Oh, wow.
Together. Yeah. They advanced into Tunisia, where Christopher and his squad were almost killed when the squadron's airfield was bombed. He had a lot of very, very close calls.
Yeah, sounds like
through his time in the RAF. When the Axis surrendered in North Africa in May 1943, his squadron moved to Libya in preparation to support the Allied invasion of Sicily. They moved to Malta when it was captured at the end of July 1943, and he received his second promotion of the year to flying officer. After the Sicilian campaign ended, he came down with malaria for the 6th time in a year.
Wow. Mosquitoes must love him.
And he was flown to the hospital in Carthage. When he returned, he found that the squad that he was part of was restless. They were frustrated with the lack of news from the Eastern Front in the Soviet Union, and they had no mail from home and no alcohol.
How dare.
Concerned that this would turn into a mutiny, Christopher was able to talk to the squad into resuming their duties, which gained further respect from his commanding officer. He basically just showed back up and completely defused the situation.
Awesome.
Just another interesting fact about and near loss of Christopher Lee's life. While in Naples on leave, he climbed Mount Vesuvius, and then 3 days later, it erupted.
Christopher. We need to have a talk.
He was involved in the Battle of Monte Cassino, where he was almost killed again when one of the planes crashed on takeoff and he tripped over a live bomb that had fallen out of the plane, I guess.
No worries. Just chill.
In November 1944, he was promoted to a flight lieutenant and left the squadron to take a post at headquarters. For the final few months of his service, as he was fluent in French, Italian, German, among other languages, he was put in Central Registry of War Criminals and Security Suspects. Here he was tasked with tracking down Nazi war criminals. He retired from the RAF in 1946 with the final rank of flight lieutenant.
Good for him.
While Christopher, like many that served in World War II, didn't speak much on the actual exploits that he took part in, especially when those things involved espionage. From everything I've read, his files are still sealed, and he took most of the details with him when he passed away in 2015. The organization he worked with was informally called the Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare.
I love that!
And a quote from Lee on his time in service, quote, "I've seen many men die right in front of me. So many, in fact, that I've become almost hardened to it. Having seen the worst that human beings can do to each other, the results of torture, mutilation, and seeing someone blown to pieces by a bomb, you develop kind of a shell. But you had to. You had to. Otherwise, we never would have won."
Mm-hmm.
End quote. There are some current concerns that Christopher Lee's military career may have been embellished, as some of the things aren't adding up. the majority of people who are saying that his stories are embellished are definitely not trying to say that he didn't do anything, mm-hmm. that he was never in the military or whatever. Like, he was definitely in the military, and he had a successful career within the military. There's some things not adding up, like the post that he was put in as far as being responsible for the war criminals and stuff wouldn't have actually seen him, like, sent to try to capture people.
Gotcha.
That he wouldn't have been sent to concentration camps. He wouldn't have done any of these things that he did say he did. But with his files still being sealed, I don't see how you can definitively say he 100% didn't do that.
Right.
He was a spy. I think that there's probably a lot that he did that we may never find out about.
I will say it again. Prove to me that he didn't. Or I can believe in it like you can believe in Jesus. Like, like, just because you don't know doesn't mean it's not true.
Of course, Sir Christopher Lee is more well known for most people for his acting chops. He was actually encouraged to go into acting after feeling unable to go back into an office type job after the war.
Yeah.
A lot of highly educated members of RAF were offered to become professors, but he didn't see the appeal in what he considered a difficult job that had very strict curfews.
Look, he's right. It would suck to be a teacher. No offense, teachers. I think you're great, but I don't think I could do it.
Yeah, and so he just wasn't interested in it, and he was talking to, I want to say it was a cousin of his, and that he, in Italy, and he was just like, I don't know what I'm going to do. And his cousin suggested that he get back into acting.
Yeah.
Because he had loved it so much when he was younger. Like, now's a great time to do it. And I didn't really get into, like, his marriages and relationships and stuff, but I thought it was really interesting. He had a fiance at one point and cared very deeply for her, got permission to marry her and everything, blah, blah, blah. But when he actually decided to, like, pursue acting, he approached her about breaking the marriage off, like, the engagement off.
Aww.
Because he was concerned that he wouldn't be able to support her how she deserved to be supported while he was, like, becoming an actor.
Yeah.
And she agreed, and they separated amiably. Mm-hmm. Yeah, as far as I can tell. But I was just like, oh, this is so responsible of you to be like, look, I don't know how this is gonna go.
Yeah.
But he did end up getting married and having a daughter. And I believe that he married a artist, like a painter or a sculptor.
Okay.
And married the whole rest of his life to her. So some of his notable roles include The Curse of Frankenstein from 1957, where he was the creature.
Mm-hmm.
Horror of Dracula in 1958. He actually played Dracula a lot.
I didn't know that, actually.
A lot. So Christopher Lee, for people who aren't familiar or are only familiar with him, like, from movies, kind of hard to tell. He was, like, 6'5".
Yeah.
So he was, like, a super imposing man with, like, an intense gaze, this, like, deep bass baritone voice, you know, so he really fit the horror movie villain sort of model, mm-hmm. which is why he did so much of it, especially early in his career. So in The Mummy 1959, he was the mummy, or Karras. Like we said at the beginning of the episode, he was in The Wicker Man in 1973, where he played Lord Summerisle.
I love that movie.
It's so good.
That is the exact type of horror, like, scary movie that I like, where it's, like, a little psychological, and you're like, what the fuck's going on? And, like,
did you watch Midsommar?
I don't think so.
I've heard a lot of people say that if you liked the, like, original Wicker Man, it's another, mm-hmm. like, folk horror.
Okay.
Where, like, everything happens during the day, and it's all, like, real weird.
Yeah, I like it. It's like
a cult sacrificing people in the woods.
Mm-hmm.
That a lot of people have called it, like, this era's Wicker Man.
Okay. I'll have to look into it.
So he was in several movies related to the Three Musketeers, starting in 1973, where he played Rochefort. He was in The Man with the Golden Sun as Scaramanga in 1974. So this is actually a James Bond movie. And this is one of his more notable, his kind of like first step into like Hollywood.
Like breakout roles.
Yeah. This was the first one that wasn't like a, at the time, like obviously now The Wicker Man is hugely popular.
Right.
But the time it came out, it wasn't so much. It took some time to for it to catch on. But a James Bond movie.
James Bond. And that brings us back around to Ian Fleming.
Yeah. So there's also some suggestions that James Bond was actually loosely based on Christopher Lee's work as a spy.
Interesting.
Ian Fleming was his cousin, after all.
This wasn't supposed to be a James Bond inspiration episode. I'm just saying. How did we both do that?
So he was he did a lot of voice acting, too, because if that you've voice. Heard him speak, yeah, it really lends itself. So he was in The Last Unicorn in 1982. He played King Haggard in English and in German.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's fun.
He was in Gremlins 2, The New Batch in 1990, where he played Dr. Cather. He was in the Lord of the Rings trilogy from 2001 to 2003, where he played Saruman the White. He also voice acted Saruman in all of the games.
Oh, like, I didn't know that.
All of the games that came out from 2001 to 2015 when he passed away, that's the voice of Saruman.
That's awesome.
He even came back and did Saruman for The Hobbit extended editions. They had to, I was reading, and it's like one of the last things I was reading, but they actually had to change how they filmed him because he didn't feel comfortable or like healthy enough to fly to New Zealand. So they basically like set him up to film in London where he was living.
Aww.
So that he could still be in the movie without having to travel across the world to get in the movie. Because I don't think he's in much. I think he's just in a little bit of The Hobbit extended editions. So, you know, he was just like, I don't really want to fly to New Zealand for like 3 days of filming.
That's fair.
So he was in Star Wars Episode III, Revenge of the Sith in 2005 as Count Dooku. He would also go on to voice Count Dooku in everything up until his death. So everything that has Count Dooku in it is him.
Hmm.
He also voiced Ansem in Kingdom Hearts 2,
yes,
which is like the villain leader. And he also voiced him in everything Kingdom Hearts related until his death in 2015. And he was literally acting in 2015. Yeah. Like, he never retired. He actually this is a small smat. These are just what I think are, like, his most notable roles. He was in Sleepy Hollow. He was in
Hugo.
He was in Hugo. He was in, he was the narrator for some like video game version of Rocky Horror.
What?
Yeah. I guess, and he had been in like a stage production as the narrator, like as the detective. What else? He was in Corpse Bride. He was in Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, the Johnny Depp version.
He was Johnny Depp's dad.
Yeah. He's been a narrator in several documentaries. He is the, if you like audiobooks and you like Tolkien, he does the audiobook version of The Children of Húrin, which sounds so good, but Elise has warned me that their story is very sad, and I don't know. There are other audiobooks that he's done as well. And like I said, his IMDb page is literally nonstop from like 1954 or even earlier. He was even acting in the 40s all the way up to 2015. Actually, there's a movie that's not out yet that has him in it from 27 that's in post-production still.
Yeah, that's because I always think of him outside of like those big roles. Like, I always, you're in a movie, you're just chilling, you're like, what's gonna happen next? And then they introduce a guy for like five scenes and it's Christopher Lee and you're like, what?
Yeah.
I was not expecting to see you.
Like the in Sleepy Hollow, he's in it for like 30 seconds.
Yeah.
And same with Willy Wonka. He's in it for like 30 seconds. And he does the narration.
Yeah.
But so when he was 88 years old, he released a metal album.
Yes, he did.
Charlemagne by the Sword and the Cross. He would go on to release additional follow-up albums. He won a... I didn't write it down. I wish I had. He won an award. He won like the Hammer of Metal for like a kind of lifetime achievement sort of award. Like I was talking about at the beginning of the episode, he sang opera because he had a deep bass, and he was involved with various bands and musicians, primarily as like guesting on songs and albums, including Manowar. I want to say that there was a song that they, I think it was Manowar, that they were wanting to redo from one of their old albums, and they originally had Orson Welles on the album doing the reading, because Orson Welles was super dead by the time they were redoing it, they had Christopher Lee come in to do the reading on the album, and just tons of different things that he's been noted with. He was also knighted in 2009 for his achievements both in the military as well as to the art of drama and acting. He passed away in 2015, shortly after his 93rd birthday, due to respiratory problems related to heart failure.
Aww.
And his family actually kept it, like, secret. Didn't alert anybody for a few days, for about a week, so they could have time.
Yeah.
And, because it happened very suddenly, too. Like, he hadn't been... I mean, obviously, he was 93, so at a certain point, you have to start preparing for everything, you know?
Yeah.
But it was, unexpected. You know, it wasn't like he was on a downward slope with cancer or something.
Right.
And his daughter also is, sings and has worked with him on some albums as a backup singer as well.
Well, that's neat.
And as far as I could find, he only had the one daughter, with his wife.
Okay.
But yeah, so, you know, we don't know a ton of the espionage that he did, only what he has talked about, which is very limited. He himself has said that he, or had said, that he was told to not talk about it. That he was specifically told to not say anything, which is another thing that some of the naysayers or people who disagree with some of the things that he is attributed with are saying is incorrect, because no other members of what is like the SAE or whatever, the special operations group, were told to, they couldn't talk about it. He's like the only one who says that he couldn't talk about it.
That makes sense though. Like,
yeah, it depends on what he was tasked with.
Well, not only that, but a lot of like AJ, my husband, for those of you who don't know, was intel when he was in the army. Uh-huh. And he's not allowed to talk about the shit he learned and did. And we're not in those same situations we were in back then. Like,
yeah,
you're still not supposed to talk about it.
Yeah, but another member of the same like organization evidently put out a book about everything that he did in like 1948 and received no like
That doesn't issue. Mean he was supposed to.
Yeah.
They probably said, hey, please don't do that. And then he did. And was like, well, we didn't tell you you couldn't. We just asked you not to.
Well, and again, without like, if Christopher Lee's files really are still sealed, then who knows what he had been tasked with doing. He could have been tasked with doing something way more a secret than that other dude had.
Yep.
Like, not all spies are given the same things. That's why they're spies.
Yep.
You know? But anyway, I learned a bunch about Christopher Lee and had a good time with it.
Well, so did I just now. Thank you. That's so weird that we both ended up with a... They were possibly the inspiration for said character in Ian Fleming.
Yeah, and I think that it's honestly pretty viable for both of them. But especially with Christopher Lee being related to...
Yeah.
I mean, by marriage, but still.
Well, and with Christine being notably Churchill's favorite spy, like, it would make a lot of sense that she would then be revered in the kind of way that would make people want to write about her. So like, I totally get either side of it.
Yeah, I 100% do.
Pretty cool. I am not like a big James Bond person.
I'm not either. I've considered giving the books a try.
I was just gonna say, I liked the Casino Royale movie because it was Ava Green and Mads Mikkelsen, and I liked that, but that was The only one that I was like, man, I really don't want to stop watching this one. So
I don't think I've ever actually seen a James Bond movie from beginning to end.
I saw Skyfall in the movie theater because AJ's mom wanted to go because she was in love with Daniel Craig.
I mean, Skyfall does have a bop of a theme, though.
It do. I feel like, side note for everybody, I feel like in a long time, Adele's Skyfall was the first one that felt like one of the old
James Bond songs. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, thanks for joining us today while we discussed a couple of impressive spies and their exploits during and after their spying. We hope that you will reach out to us with your own experiences. We want your stories, your questions, and your feedback. So just send us an email at strangeunusualpodcast@gmail.com. If you are sending a story, we just ask that you put listener story in the subject line so that we can sort through those a little more easily. Were you a spy during World War II? Because we want to know.
Were you an inspiration for James for Bond?
Fleming? We need to know, people. We will give you all of our deviled eggs.
Throwback. You can also find us on Instagram at strange_unusual_podcast or our personal accounts Roy Rampage and Calamity Casey, where we post the weird shit in our personal lives. You can find us on Twitter at _strangeunusual, at Calamity Casey, and at Roy Rampage. We're also on Facebook. Just search for the Strange and Unusual Podcast. If you'd like, you can come on over and join us on patreon.com/strangeunusual. We have bonus episodes of access to our Patreon, access to our Discord.
You do get access to our Patreon.
You do. Potentially early episodes, depending on how quickly Roy can edit them, and various other things, and hopefully more that will be coming, especially as we acquire more Patreons. And have patrons.
Whatever.
But we understand if you can't, and it's totally fair and valid right now in the time of the apocalypse.
Yeah. Late stage capitalism. We get it.
But if you can, we'd just like if you'd share, rate, review, comment, subscribe, do all those things, click all the buttons, write some words, interact with us on social media.
Share us with your friends, with your enemies, with your deviled eggs.
Play us while you make deviled eggs. We'll make them extra devil-y.
Yeah. Super deviled.
Double deviled.
That's us.
But yeah, just interact with us on social media. It means a lot. If there's an episode that you would like to see that we haven't done, or some content that you're really surprised we haven't explored yet, feel free to drop us a message on, especially on Twitter. I think it's the easiest one to do it on. But tag us and let us know if there's something cool happening or something you'd like to hear us talk about.
Heck yeah.
And there is a level on Patreon, I will say, where you can just tell us to talk about things and we'll do it with a few caveats.
Yep.
Mainly Roy's caveats.
Yeah, Casey doesn't have caveats until she learns about them. So unless you give me something really horrible and then I have to talk about it, I'm pretty open.
My caveats are also Casey's caveats.
That's currently true.
Because I don't want to hear about those cases either.
Well, I mean, I'm curious what those cases
are. Then you can support us on Patreon, and I will talk to you about them in Discord. I won't cover them.
I assume that if it's too bad for you to want to cover, it's way too bad for me to want to cover.
They're the only two that I almost stopped reading about them in the middle.
Ooh.
And was just like, and I think I'm done.
And we talked about that guy from South America, that goofy guy, which is pretty bad.
Yeah, who killed like 400 kids.
Don't like
that. And I still talk about how I want to cover what's his face, the Nazi doctor.
Lampshade guy?
Skin
lampshade?
Mengele.
Yeah. Mengele. Yeah.
Mengele, yeah.
Yeah.
The one who had the obsession with twins.
Yes.
Anyway.
And he named them Bradley and Brian.
Throwback.
Bye.